If your dial shifted or you pressed the wrong button and you are wondering where you are, you have landed in the wonderful land of WGXC. Whoa, I'm turning upside down. Wait, I'm not anymore.
Hi, this is John Hall. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 Acre.
If you like music that's off the beaten path, and often off the beat, then tune in to Overlooked, the second and fourth Tuesday of the month, just after the noon news. You'll hear underplayed and overlooked music of all genres, continents, and omniverses, Overlooked on WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies. You're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, in the name of the show, Good Night, Norman, right here on WGXC 90.7 FM on your radio dial in the beautiful Hudson Valley. Just take I-87 to Route 21 and tune in, turn on, snooze out. Alternatively, you can listen on WGXC.org on the World Wide Web, practically anywhere in the world. Tonight, I'm going to try to make it through a couple of stories about the unreliable narrator. I could credit my choice of these stories, but I didn't really prepare that. I mean, it's from an article called Anyways, the author cites both of these stories, and I, in an effort to discuss quantum poetics, in the New Atlantis. Quantum poetics. Why Physics Can't Get Rid of Metaphor by Samuel Matlack. Check it out. I don't necessarily agree with the writer, but I don't disagree with him either. And now, without further ado, Hugo von Hofmannsthal's A Letter. I believe this is from 1902. This is the letter written by Philip, Lord Chandos, the younger son of the Earl of Bath, to Francis Bacon, later Lord Verulam Viscount St. Albans, apologizing for his complete abandonment of literary activity. Here's the letter. It is kind of you, dear friend, to ignore my silence of 2 years and write to me as you have done. to express your concern about me. You're disquieted what you see as the mental paralysis into which I have fallen with such grace and humor, as only great people who know in their bones how dangerous life is and still have not lost hope can do. This goes beyond kindness. You conclude with Hippocrates' aphorism, qui gravi morbo corrupti dolores non sentiunt is mens aegrotat. One who is suffering from a severe illness yet feels no pain is sick in mind. And you express your belief that I need medicine not merely to cure my illness, but to heighten my awareness of my inner state. I would like to give you the response that you deserve. I want to open myself up to you entirely, but I do not know how I am to set about it. I hardly know if I am still the person your precious letter is addressing. I am now 26. Am I the same person as the 19-year-old who wrote The New Paris, The Dream of Daphne, Epithalamium, those pastorals tottering under the weight of their grand words, which a great queen and a number of older and overindulgent lords and gentry are gracious enough to still remember? Am I the one who at 23, among the stone arcades of the grand piazza of Venice, discovered in himself an edifice of Latin prose whose abstract plan and structure gladdened his heart more than the buildings of Palladio and Sansovino that rise out of the sea? And supposing I am that person, though changed, could my unknowable self have lost all traces and scars of this product of my most strenuous thinking so completely that the title of the little treatise looks back at me strange and cold from your letter here before me, so completely that I did not even perceive it right away as a familiar image made of words strung together, but was able to understand it only by taking it one word at a time, as though I had never seen this combination of Latin vocabulary. But in fact, that was me and no one else, and there is rhetoric in these questions. Rhetoric is fine for women or the House of Commons, but its armamentarium, so overvalued by our time, is not equal to getting at the heart of things. And I will have to show you what is inside me, a freak, a foible, a mental illness, if you like, if you are to understand that the literary works which I am supposed to have ahead of me are separated from me by a gulf as unbridgeable as the ones behind me. And those I hesitate to call my own, so unfamiliar do they seem. When you remind me of the various little projects I used to entertain during the days of such fine ardor that we spent together, I do not know which to admire more, the force of your goodwill or the incredible accuracy of your memory. It is true I did want to give an account of the first years of the reign of our late glorious sovereign Henry VIII. The notes left by my grandfather, the Duke of Exeter, on his negotiations with France and Portugal gave me something to build upon, and in those happy, lively days an awareness of form was flowing from Sallust to me, as though through conduits that had never been blocked, the kind of deep and true inner form of whose existence one can have no suspicion while still within the province of rhetorical tricks, which is no longer just lending order to the material because it permeates it, abolishes it, and creates poetry and truth all at once. A play of eternal forces, a thing as magnificent as music or algebra. That was the project dearest to me. What is man that he conceives projects? And there were other projects I toyed with. Your kind letter brings these back too. They dance before me like miserable mosquitoes on a dim wall no longer illuminated by the bright sun of a happy time, each of them engorged with a drop of my blood. I wanted to show that the fables and mythic tales which the ancients have handed down to us and in which painters and sculptors never cease to find mindless pleasure are the hieroglyphics of a secret and inexhaustible wisdom. I sometimes thought I felt its breath as though coming from behind a veil. I remember this project, what sensual and spiritual desire it originated in, I do not know. I long to enter into those naked glistening bodies, those sirens and dryads, Narcissus and Proteus, Perseus and Actaeon, the same way a hunted deer longs to wade into the water. I wanted to disappear into them and speak out of them with their tongues. I wanted all sorts of other things. I plan to put together a collection of maxims like Julius Caesar's. You remember that Cicero mentions it in one of his letters. My plan here was to assemble the most remarkable utterances which I had collected during my travels and my dealings with the learned men and clever women of our time, with exceptional individuals from among the general public, and with the cultivated and distinguished. In this way, I wished to combine beautiful classical and Italian aphorisms and reflections with whatever else I had run across in the way of intellectual baubles in books, manuscripts, and conversation, and also to include particularly beautiful festivals and pageants, strange crimes and cases of dementia, descriptions of the greatest and oddest buildings in the Netherlands, France, and Italy, and much more. But the work as a whole was to be entitled Nosce de Ipsium, Know Thyself. To put it briefly, I lived at that time in a kind of continuous inebriation and saw all of existence as one great unity. The mental world did not seem to me to be opposed to the physical. Likewise, the courtly and the bestial, art and barbarism, solitude and society. I felt nature in all of it, and the aberrations of insanity just as much as in the most refined subtleties of a Spanish ceremonial, in the crudities of young peasants no less than in the loveliest allegory, and in all of nature I felt myself. To me there was no difference between drinking warm, foaming milk which a tousled rustic at my hunting lodge had squeezed into a wooden bucket from the udder of a fine, mild-eyed cow, and drinking in sweet and frothy spiritual nourishment from an old book as I sat in the window seat of my study. The one was like the other. Neither was inferior to the other, either in its intangible spirituality or in its physical power. And so it went throughout the entire sweep of life all around me. Everywhere I was in the midst of it, I never noticed anything false. At other times, I had the intuition that everything was symbolism and every creature a key to all the others, and I felt I was surely the one who could take hold of each in turn and unlock as many of the others as would open. Thus, the title which I had planned to give that encyclopedic book. To someone susceptible to such notions, it may appear to be the well-conceived plan of a divine providence that my soul had to sink from such puffed-up arrogance to this extremity of faint-heartedness and exhaustion which is now my permanent inner state. But such religious ideas have no power over me. They belong to the cobwebs through which my thoughts pass as they shoot into the void, but upon which so many others are snagged and remain. For me, the mysteries of faith have boiled down to a grand allegory which stands over the fields of my life like a shining rainbow at a constant remove, always ready to recede in case I think of running up and wrapping myself in the hem of its cloak. But, dear friend, worldly ideas, too, are retreating from me in the same way. How shall I describe these strange spiritual torments, the boughs of fruit snatched from my outstretched hands, the murmuring water shrinking from my parched lips? In brief, this is my case. I have completely lost the ability to think or speak coherently about anything at all. First, I gradually lost the ability, when discussing relatively elevated or general topics, to utter words normally used by everyone with unhesitating fluency. I felt an inexplicable uneasiness in even pronouncing the words spirit, soul, or body. I found myself profoundly unable to produce an opinion on affairs of court, events in parliament, what have you. And not out of any kind of scruples, you know my candor, which borders on thoughtlessness, rather the abstract words which the tongue must enlist as a matter of course in order to bring out an opinion disintegrated in my mouth like rotten mushrooms. It happened to me that when I wanted to scold my 4-year-old daughter, Katerina Pompilia, for a childish lie she had told and impressed upon her the necessity of always telling the truth, the ideas flowing into my mouth suddenly took on such iridescent hues and merged into each other to such a degree that I had to make an effort to sputter to the end of my sentence as if I had fallen ill. I actually turned pale, and feeling an intense pressure on my forehead, left the child, slammed the door behind me, and did not recover somewhat until I was riding at a good gallop over secluded pasture land. But this affliction gradually broadened, like spreading rust. Even in simple, informal conversation, all the opinions which are ordinarily offered casually and with the sureness of a sleepwalker became so fraught with difficulties that I had to stop participating in these conversations at all. It filled me with inexplicable fury. I concealed it just barely and with effort to hear such things as, "This matter turned out well or badly for this person or that," or "Sheriff N is a bad person and Clergyman T is good," or "We ought to feel sorry for Farmer M, his sons are throwing their money away," or "Someone else is to be envied because his daughters are thrifty," or "One family is coming up in the world and another is on the way down." All of this seemed to me as unprovable, as false, as full of holes as could be. My mind forced me to see everything that came up in these conversations as terrifyingly close to me. Once I saw through a magnifying glass that an area of skin on my little finger looked like an open field with furrows and hollows. That was how it was for me now with people and their affairs. I could no longer grasp them with the simplifying gaze of habit. Everything came to pieces. The pieces broke into more pieces, and nothing could be encompassed by one idea. Isolated words swam about me. They turned into eyes that stared at me and into which I had to stare back, dizzying whirlpools which spun around and around and led into the void. I tried to rescue myself from this state by entering the spiritual world of antiquity. Plato I avoided. I dreaded his metaphorical fancy. Most of all, it was my intent to follow Seneca and Cicero. I hoped to heal myself with their harmony of well-defined and orderly ideas, but I could not find my way to them. I understood these ideas well. I saw their marvelous interplay rise up before me like golden spears bobbing on magnificent fountains. I could float around them and watch how they played off one another, but they had to do only with one another. And what was most profound, what was personal in my thinking, was not a part of their dance. A feeling of terrible loneliness came over me while I was among them. I felt like someone locked in a garden full of eyeless statuary, and I rushed to get out again. Since then, I have led an existence which I fear you could hardly imagine, so inanely, so unconsciously has it been proceeding. Yet, it is not too different from that of my neighbors, my relatives, and most of the landed gentry of this kingdom, and it is not entirely without happy and stirring moments. It will not be easy for me to convey the substance of these good moments to you. Words fail me once again, for what makes its presence felt to me at such times, filling any mundane object around me with a swelling tide of higher life, as if it were a vessel, in fact, has no name and is no doubt hardly nameable. I cannot expect you to understand me without an illustration, and I must ask you to forgive the silliness of my examples. A watering can, a harrow left in a field, a dog in the sun, a shabby churchyard, a cripple, a small farmhouse. Any of these can become the vessel of my revelation. Any of these things and the thousand similar ones past which the eye ordinarily glides with natural indifference can at any moment, which I am completely unable to elicit, suddenly take on for me a sublime and moving aura which words seem too weak to describe. Even an absent object, clearly imagined, can inexplicably be chosen to be filled to the brim with this smoothly but steeply rising tide of heavenly feeling. Recently, for example, I had a generous amount of rat poison spread in the milk cellars of one of my dairy farms. I went out riding toward evening, thinking no more about the matter, as you might imagine. As I rode at a walk over deep, tilled farmland, nothing more significant in the vicinity than a startled covey of quail, the great setting sun off in the distance above the convex fields. Suddenly, this cellar unrolled inside me, filled with the death throes of the pack of rats. It was all there, the cool and musty cellar air, full of the sharp, sweetish smell of the poison and the shrilling of the death cries echoing against mildewed walls. Those convulsed clumps of powerlessness, those desperations colliding with one another in confusion, the frantic search for ways out, the cold glares of fury when two meet at a blocked crevice. But why am I searching again for words which I have sworn off? My friend, do you remember Livy's wonderful description of the hours before the destruction of Alba Longa? The people wandering through the streets that they will never see again, saying goodbye to the rocks on the ground? I tell you, my friend, this was in me, and Carthage in flames too. But it was more than that. It was more divine, more bestial, and it was the present, the fullest, most sublime present. A mother was there, whose dying young thrashed about her, but she was not looking at those in their death agonies, or at the unyielding stone walls, but off into space, or through space into the infinite, and gnashing her teeth as she looked. If there was a slave standing near Niobe in helpless fright as she turned to stone, he must have gone through what I went through when the soul of this beast I saw within me bared its teeth to its dreadful fate. Forgive this description, but do not think it was pity that I felt. If you think so, my example was poorly chosen. It was much more and much less than pity. A vast empathy, a streaming across into those creatures, or a feeling that a flux of life and death, of dreaming and waking, had streamed into them for an instant. But from where? Where could you find pity or any comprehensible association of human ideas if on some other evening I find under a nut tree a half-full watering can that a gardener's boy has forgotten there? And this watering can, and the water in it, dark from the shadow of the tree, and a water beetle sculling on the surface of the water from one dark shore to the other, this confluence of triviality shoots through me from the roots of my hair to the marrow of my toes with such a presence of the infinite that I want to bring out words, knowing that any words I found would vanquish these cherubim in which I do not believe. And then I turn away from this place in silence. And when I see this nut tree weeks later, I go by with a cautious sidelong glance, because I do not wish to frighten off the feeling of the marvelous remaining in the air around its trunk, to drive away the tremors of the supernatural still pulsating through the shrubbery in that place. At those moments, an insignificant creature, a dog, a rat, a beetle, a stunted apple tree, a cart path winding over the hill, a moss-covered stone mean more to me than the most beautiful, most abandoned lover ever did on the happiest night. These mute and sometimes inanimate beings rise up before me with such a plenitude, such a presence of love that my joyful eye finds nothing dead anywhere. Everything seems to mean something, everything that exists, everything I can remember, everything in the most muddled of my thoughts, even my own heaviness, the usual dullness of my brain seems to mean something. I feel a blissful and utterly eternal interplay in me and around me, and amid the to and fro, there is nothing into which I cannot merge. Then it is as if my body consisted entirely of coded messages revealing everything to me, or as if we could enter into a new momentous relationship with all of existence if we began to think with our hearts. But when this strange bewitchment stops, I am unable to say anything about it. I can no more express in rational language what made up this harmony permeating me and the entire world, or how it made itself perceptible to me, than I can describe with any precision the inner movements of my intestines or the engorgement of my veins. apart from these strange chance events, which I hardly know whether to call mental or physical, I live a life of scarcely credible emptiness. I have trouble concealing from my wife how hard my heart has become, and from the people working for me how bored I am by the affairs of the estate. It seems to me that the good, strict upbringing for which I have my late father to thank and my long-standing habit of leaving no hour in the day unoccupied are the only things giving my life a semblance of acceptable stability and maintaining an appearance appropriate to my position and my person. I am renovating one wing of my house, and find myself able to have a chat with the architect now and then about the progress of his work. I manage my properties, and my tenants and staff will very likely find me somewhat more taciturn, but no less generous than before. As they stand with their caps off in front of their doors when I ride by in the evening, none of them will have an inkling that my gaze, which they are accustomed to meeting with respect, is passing with silent longing over the rotten boards under which they hunt for earthworms to use for bait. It is ducking through the narrow barred window into the dismal room in whose corner a low bed with colorful sheets always seems to be waiting for someone to die or be born, that my eye is lingering for a long time on the ugly puppies or the cats slinking lithely between flower pots and searching among all the shabby and crude objects of a rough life for that one whose unprepossessing form, whose unnoticed presence lying on or leaning against something, whose mute existence can become the source of that mysterious, wordless, infinite rapture. For my nameless, joyful feeling will come not from contemplating the starry sky, but more likely from a lonely shepherd's fire in the distance, from the stridulation of the last dying cricket, as autumn winds are already driving wintry crowds over the empty fields, not the majestic rumbling of an organ. And sometimes I compare myself in my thoughts with Crassus, the orator. The story is that he grew so inordinately fond of a tame eel, a dull, mute, red-eyed fish in his ornamental pond, that it became the talk of the town. And when Domitius disparaged him in the Senate for shedding tears over the death of this fish, wishing to portray him as something of a fool, Crassus replied, "When my fish died, I did what you did not when your first wife died, or your second." I do not know how often this Crassus with his eel has hurtled across the centuries into my mind as a reflection of myself. His response to Domitius is not the reason, however. That brought the ones who laughed onto his side, so that the substance of the thing was diffused into a witticism. But that substance is what cuts me to the quick, and it would have been no different even if Domitius had wept bitterly and with the most sincere distress over his wives. There would still have been Crassus crying over his eel, and an inexpressible something forces me to think about this figure, whose ludicrousness and contemptibility I see so perfectly in the middle of a senate, running the world and discussing deadly serious business in a way that seems completely foolish to me as soon as I try to express it in words. The image of Crassus is sometimes in my brain at night, like a splinter with everything around it, a throbbing, boiling infection. Then it is as if I myself were beginning to ferment, to foam, seethe and give off sparks, and the whole thing is a kind of feverish thinking, but thinking in a medium more direct, fluid, and passionate than words. It has whirlpools too, but ones which seem to lead not into the abyss as whirlpools of language do, but into myself in some way, and into the lap of the most profound peace. Dear friend, I have tried your patience too much with this lengthy description of an inexplicable state which ordinarily remains bottled up within me. You were kind enough to express your regret that no more books by me have been arriving to, quote, make up for the loss of our companionship, end quote. When I read that, I knew, not without a pang, that I would write no books either in English or in Latin in the coming year, the years after that, or in all the years of this life of mine. There is only one reason for this, a strange and embarrassing one. I leave it to your infinite intellectual superiority to give it a place among what, to your clear eyes, is an orderly array of mental and physical phenomena. It is that the language in which I might have been granted the opportunity not only to write, but also to think, is not Latin or English or Italian or Spanish, but a language of which I know not one word, a language in which mute things speak to me and in which I will perhaps have something to say for myself some day when I am dead and standing before an unknown judge. I had wanted, had it only been permitted me, to squeeze into the closing words of this, the last letter I expect I will write to Francis Bacon, all the love and gratitude, all the boundless admiration which I bear in my heart for the one who has done the most for my spirit, the foremost Englishman of my time, and which I will continue to bear in my heart until death bursts it. And that's dated August 22nd, 1603. Of course, the letter written by Hofmannsthal as a fiction was written in 1902. Hugo von Hofmannsthal, the infamous Lord Chandos letter. well, that took like half of the show, exactly what I kind of wanted. So, yeah, we're here. It's Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, and this is your host, Norman Douglas, and this is your show for this remaining half hour. Good night, Norman, and this is WGXC 90.7 FM, broadcasting to you live from the salon at my crib on State Street in Hudson, New York. Right now, for the second half of the show, I'm going to hit you up with some more of that unreliable narrator business, coming to you from one of the kings of the unreliable narrator, Jorge Luis Borges, the Argentine. I probably won't get through this entire tale, but I'm going to give it a shot. I'm not going to get through this entire tale because I'm not going to read the entire tale. The entire tale is written in a few parts. It's a short story, but nonetheless, I think there's three or four parts to it. I'm going to start at the second part. The name of the story is Tlan Ukbar Orbis Tertius. And it's from one of his, I think it was the first collection translated into English, Ficciones. But there's some dispute about it now with his wife, who didn't like the translator, whose name happened to be Norman as well. I mean, he wasn't the full translator of all the stories, because a lot of the stories Borges translated with Mr. DiGiovanni, Norman, that is, and Bioia Casares and others. I think there is a woman translator whose name eludes me, of course, because I am, I guess, unfortunately, indoctrinated into that kind of thinking. But nonetheless, this is Tlan Ukbar Orbis Tertius from Ficciones by Jorge Luis Borges, part 2. Some small fading memory of one Herbert Ashe, an engineer for the Southern Railroads, hangs on in the hotel in Andrew Gay between the luscious honeysuckle and the illusory depths of his mirrors. In life he suffered from a sense of unreality, as do so many Englishmen. Dead, he is not even the ghostly creature he was then. He was tall and languid. His limp squared beard had once been red. He was, I understand, a widower and childless. Every so many years he went to England to visit. Judging by the photographs he showed us, a sundial and some oak trees. My father and he had cemented, the verb is excessive, one of those English friendships which begin by avoiding intimacies and eventually eliminate speech altogether. They used to exchange books and periodicals. They would beat one another at chess without saying a word. I remember him in the corridor of the hotel, a mathematics textbook in his hand, gazing now and again at the passing colors of the sky. One afternoon, we discussed the duodecimal numerical system in which 12 is written 10. Ashe said that, as a matter of fact, he was transcribing some duodecimal tables, I forget which, into sexagesimals, in which 60 is written 10, adding that this work had been commissioned by a Norwegian in Rio Grande do Sul. We had known him for 8 years, and he had never mentioned having stayed in that part of the country. We spoke of rural life, of capangas, of the Brazilian etymology of the word gaucho, which some old people in the East still pronounce gaucho, and nothing more was said, God forgive me, of duodecimal functions. In September 1937, we ourselves were not at the hotel at the time, Herbert Ashe died of an aneurysmal rupture. Some days before, he had received from Brazil a stamped registered package. It was a book, an octavo volume. Ashe left it in the bar, where months later I found it. I began to leaf through it and felt a sudden curious lightheadedness, which I will not go into, since this is the story not of my particular emotions, but of Ukbar and Tlan and Orbis Tertius. In the Islamic world, there is one night called the Night of Nights, on which the secret gates of the sky open wide and the water in the water jugs taste sweeter. If those gates were to open, I would not feel what I felt that afternoon. The book was written in English. It had 1,001 pages. On the yellow leather spine and again on the title page, I read these words, A First Encyclopedia of Tlan, Volume 11. Hilaire, H-L-A-E-R, Tujanger, J-A-N-G-R. There was nothing to indicate either date or place of origin. On the first page and on a sheet of silk paper covering one of the colored engravings, there was a blue oval stamp with the inscription Orbis Tertius. It was 2 years since I had discovered in a volume of a pirated encyclopedia a brief description of a false country. Now chance was showing me something much more valuable, something to be reckoned with. Now I had in my hands a substantial fragment of the complete history of an unknown planet, with its architecture and its playing cards, its mythological terrors and the sound of its dialects, its emperors and its oceans, its minerals, its birds and its fishes, its algebra and its fire, its theological and metaphysical arguments, all clearly stated, coherent, without any apparent dogmatic intention or parodic undertone. The 11th volume of which I speak refers to both subsequent and preceding volumes. Nestor Ibarra, in an article in the NRF, now a classic, has denied the existence of those corollary volumes. Ezequiel Martinez, Estrada, and Dru La Rochelle have, I think, succeeded in refuting this doubt. The fact is that up until now, the most patient investigations have proved fruitless. We have turned the libraries of Europe, North and South America upside down, in vain. Alfonso Reyes, bored with the tedium of this minor detective work, proposes that we all take on the task of reconstructing the missing volumes, many and vast as they were, ex ungue leonum. He calculates half seriously that one generation of Tlanists would be enough. This bold estimate brings us back to the basic problem. Who are the people who had invented Tlan? The plural is unavoidable because we have unanimously rejected the idea of a single creator, some transcendental Leibniz working in modest obscurity. We conjecture that this, quote, brave new world, end quote, was the work of a secret society of astronomers, biologists, engineers, metaphysicians, poets, chemists, mathematicians, moralists, painters, and geometricians, all under the supervision of an unknown genius. There are plenty of individuals who have mastered these various disciplines without having any facility for invention, far less for submitting that inventiveness to a strict systematic plan. This plan is so vast that each individual contribution to it is infinitesimal. To begin with, Tlan was thought to be nothing more than a chaos, a free and irresponsible work of the imagination. Now it was clear that it is a complete cosmos, and that the strict laws which govern it have been carefully formulated, albeit provisionally. It is enough to note that the apparent contradictions in the 11th volume are the basis for proving the existence of the others. So lucid and clear is the scheme maintained in it. The popular magazines have publicized with pardonable zeal the zoology and topography of Tlan. I think, however, that its transparent tigers and its towers of blood scarcely deserve the unwavering attention of all men. I should like to take some little time to deal with its conception of the universe. Hume remarked once and for all that the arguments of Berkeley were not only thoroughly unanswerable, but thoroughly unconvincing. This dictum is emphatically true as it applies to our world, but it falls down completely in Tlan. The nations of that planet are congenitally idealist. Their language, with its derivatives, religion, literature, and metaphysics, presupposes idealism. For them, the world is not a concurrence of objects in space, but a heterogeneous series of independent acts. It is serial and temporal, but not spatial. There are no nouns in the hypothetical Ursprach of Tlan, which is the source of the living language and the dialects. There are impersonal verbs qualified by monosyllabic suffixes or prefixes, which have the force of adverbs. For example, there is no word corresponding to the noun moon, but there is a verb to moon or to mundel. The moon rose over the sea would be written Lor ufang axaxaxes mlu, or to put it in order, upward beyond the constant flow, there was moondling. Shul Solar translates it succinctly, upward behind the onstreaming, it mooned. The previous passage refers to the languages of the southern hemisphere. In those of the northern hemisphere, the 11th volume has little information on its Ursprach. The basic unit is not the verb, but the monosyllabic adjective. Nouns are formed by an accumulation of adjectives. One does not say moon. One says airy clear over dark round, or orange faint of sky, or some other accumulation. In the chosen example, the mass of adjectives corresponds to a real object. The happening is completely fortuitous. In the literature of this hemisphere, as in the lesser world of Meinong, ideal objects abound, invoked and dissolved momentarily according to poetic necessity. Sometimes the faintest simultaneousness brings them about. There are objects made up of two sense elements, one visual, the other auditory, the color of a sunrise and the distant call of a bird. Other objects are made up of many elements, the sun, the water against the swimmer's chest, the vague quivering pink which one sees when the eyes are closed, the feeling of being swept away by a river or by sleep. These second-degree objects can be combined with others. Using certain abbreviations, the process is practically an infinite one. There are famous poems made up of one enormous word, a word which in truth forms a poetic object, the creation of the writer. The fact that no one believes that nouns refer to an actual reality means, paradoxically enough, that there is no limit to the numbers of them. The languages of the northern hemisphere of Tlan include all names in Indo-European languages, plus a great many other. It is no exaggeration to state that in the classical culture of Tlan, there is only one discipline, that of psychology. All others are subordinate to it. I have remarked that the men of that planet conceive of the universe as a series of mental processes, whose unfolding is to be understood only as a time sequence. Spinoza attributes to the inexhaustibly divine in man the qualities of extension and of thinking. In Tlan, nobody would understand the juxtaposition of the first, which is only characteristic of certain states of being, with the second, which is a perfect synonym for the cosmos. To put it another way, they do not conceive of the spatial as everlasting in time. The perception of a cloud of smoke on the horizon and later of the countryside on fire and later of a half-extinguished cigar which caused the conflagration would be considered an example of this association of ideas. This monism or extreme idealism completely invalidates science. To explain or to judge an event is to identify or unite it with another one. In Tlan, such connection is a later stage in the mind of the observer, which can in no way affect or illuminate the earlier stage. Each state of mind is irreducible. The mere act of giving it a name, that is, of classifying it, implies a falsification of it. From all this, it would be possible to deduce that there is no science in Tlan, let alone rational thought. The paradox, however, is that sciences exist in countless number. In philosophy, the same thing happens as happens with the nouns in the northern hemisphere. The fact that any philosophical system is bound in advance to be a dialectical game, a philosophie des arts hommes, means that systems abound, unbelievable systems, beautifully constructed or else sensational in effect. The metaphysicians of Tlan are not looking for truth, nor even for an approximation of it. They are after a kind of amazement. They consider metaphysics a branch of fantastic literature. They know that a system is nothing more than the subordination of all the aspects of the universe to some one of them. Even the phrase, quote, all the aspects, unquote, can be rejected, since it presupposes the impossible inclusion of the present moment and of past moments. Even so, the plural, quote, past moments, unquote, is inadmissible, since it supposes another impossible operation. One of the schools in Tlan has reached the point of denying time. It reasons that the present is undefined, that the future has no other reality than as present hope, and that the past is no more than present memory. Another school declares that the whole of time has already happened, that our life is a vague memory or dim reflection, doubtless false and fragmented, of an irrevocable process. Another school has it that the history of the universe, which contains the history of our lives and the most tenuous details of them, is the handwriting produced by a minor god in order to communicate with a demon. Another maintains that the universe is comparable to those code systems in which not all the symbols have meaning, and which only that which happens every 300th night is true. Another believes that while we are asleep here, we are awake somewhere else, and that thus every man is two men. Among the doctrines of Tlan, none has occasioned greater scandal than the doctrine of materialism. Some thinkers have formulated it with less clarity than zeal, as one might put forward a paradox. To clarify the general understanding of this unlikely thesis, one 11th century heresiarch offered the parable of 9 copper coins, which enjoyed in Tlan the same noisy reputation as did the Eleatic paradoxes of Zeno in their day. There are many versions of this feat of specious reasoning, which vary the number of coins and the number of discoveries. Here is the most common. On Tuesday, X ventures along a deserted road and loses 9 copper coins. On Thursday, Y finds on the road 4 coins, somewhat rusted by Wednesday's rain. On Friday, Z comes across 3 coins on the road. On Friday morning, X finds 2 coins in the corridor of his house. The heresiarch is trying to deduce from this story the reality, that is, the continuity of the 9 recovered coins. It is absurd, he states, to suppose that 4 of the coins have not existed between Tuesday and Thursday, and 3 between Tuesday and Friday afternoon, and 2 between Tuesday and Friday morning. It is logical to assume that they have existed, albeit in some secret way, in a manner whose understanding is concealed from men in every moment in all 3 places. The language of Tlan is by its nature resistant to the formulation of this paradox. Most people do not understand it. At first, the defenders of common sense confine themselves to denying the truth of the anecdote. They declare that it was a verbal fallacy based on the reckless use of 2 neological expressions, not substantiated by common usage, and contrary to the laws of strict thought. The verbs to find and to lose entail appetitio principi, since they presuppose that the first 9 coins and the second are identical. They recall that any noun, man, money, Thursday, Wednesday, rain, has only metaphorical value. They deny the misleading detail somewhat rusted by Wednesday's rain, since it assumes what must be demonstrated, the continuing existence of the 4 coins between Thursday and Tuesday. They explained that equality is one thing and identity another, and formulated a kind of reductio ad absurdum, the hypothetical case of 9 men who, on 9 successive nights, suffer a violent pain. Would it not be ridiculous, they asked, to claim that this pain is the same one each time? They said that the heresiarch was motivated mainly by the blasphemous intention of attributing the divine category of being to some ordinary coins, and that sometimes he was denying plurality, at other times not. They argued thus, that if equality entails identity, it would have to be admitted at the same time that the 9 coins are only 1 coin. Amazingly enough, these refutations were not conclusive. After the problem had been stated and restated for 100 years, one thinker, no less brilliant than the heresiarch himself, but in the Orthodox tradition, advanced a most daring hypothesis. This felicitous supposition declared that there is only 1 individual, and that this indivisible individual is every one of the separate beings in the universe, and that those beings are the instruments and masks of divinity itself. X is Y and is Z. Z finds 3 coins because he remembers that X lost them. X finds only 2 in the corridor because he remembers that the others have been recovered. The 11th volume gives us to understand that there were three principal reasons which led to the complete victory of this pantheistic idealism. First, it repudiated solipsism. Second, it made possible the retention of a psychological basis for the sciences. Third, it permitted the cult of the gods to be retained. Schopenhauer, the passionate and clear-headed Schopenhauer, advanced a very similar theory in the first volume of his Parerga und Paralipomena. The geometry of Tlön has two somewhat distinct systems, a visual one and a tactile one. The latter system corresponds to our geometry. They consider it inferior to the former. The foundation of visual geometry is the surface, not the point. This system rejects the principle of parallelism and states that, as man moves about, he alters the forms which surround him. The arithmetical system is based on the idea of indefinite numbers. It emphasizes the importance of the concepts greater and lesser, which our mathematicians symbolize. With the little arrowhead right and the arrowhead left. It states that the operation of counting modifies quantities and changes them from indefinites into definites. The fact that several individuals counting the same quantity arrive at the same result is, say they are psychologists, an example of the association of ideas or the good use of memory. We already know that in Tlön the source of all knowing is single and eternal. In literary matters, too, the dominant notion is that everything is the work of one single author. Books are rarely signed. The concept of plagiarism does not exist. It has been established that all books are the work of one single writer who is timeless and anonymous. Criticism is prone to invent authors. A critic will choose two dissimilar works, the Tao Te Ching and the Thousand and One Nights, let us say, and attribute them to the same writer, and then, with all the probity, explore the psychology of this interesting homme de lettres. The books themselves are also odd. Works of fiction are based on a single plot which runs through every imaginable permutation. Works of natural philosophy invariably include thesis and antithesis, the strict pro and con of a theory. A book which does not include its opposite or counter book is considered incomplete. Centuries and centuries of idealism have not failed to influence reality. In the very oldest regions of Tlön, it is not an uncommon occurrence for lost objects to be duplicated. Two people are looking for a pencil. The first one finds it and says nothing. The second finds a second pencil, no less real, but more in keeping with his expectation. These secondary objects are called Hronir, and even though awkward in form, are a little larger than the originals. Until recently, the Hronir were the accidental children of absent-mindedness and forgetfulness. It seems impossible that the methodical production of them has been going on for almost 100 years, but so it is stated in the 11th volume. The first attempts were fruitless. Nevertheless, the modus operandi is worthy of note. The director of one of the state prisons announced to the convicts that in an ancient riverbed certain tombs were to be found, and promised freedom to any prisoner who made an important discovery. In the months preceding the excavation, printed photographs of what was to be found were shown the prisoners. The first attempt proved that hope and zeal could be inhibiting. A week of work with shovel and pick succeeded in unearthing no hran other than a rusty wheel post-dating the experiment. This was kept a secret, and the experiment was later repeated in 4 colleges. In 3 of them, the failure was almost complete. In the 4th, the director of which died by chance during the initial excavation, the students dug up or produced a gold mask, an archaic sword, 2 or 3 earthenware urns, and the moldered, mutilated torso of a king with an inscription on his breast, which has so far not been deciphered. Thus was discovered the unfitness of witnesses who were aware of the experimental nature of this search. Well, that's about it with a paragraph left to go in the story. I don't think I'm going to make it. You've been listening to me, your host, Norman Dunn.